Great, thank you, John. Thanks a lot for the invitation to speak. I mean, when I got this invitation, I demurred quite a bit. I really hesitated and equivocated because I said to John, I'm not a historian and I'm not a public health specialist, so I miss on 0 for 2 of the things that you're likely looking for. But he convinced me that you would be interested in a more sociological take on certain aspects of global health governance, and I'm particularly going to look at development financing for health, not actually for health, sorry, development financing with a particular focus on trying to understand some aspects of the Gates Foundation and the rise of what I have termed and I'm calling rich-to-rich giving, okay, and to relate my focus on the Gates Foundation then to a discussion of the rise of various forms of public-private partnerships and some of the epistemological assumptions that are underpinning this assumption of enhanced private sector efficiency when in comparative perspective. So I had hoped actually not to talk about the Gates Foundation, having spent quite a few years carrying out research into this organization and publishing a book a year and a half ago that was called No Such Thing as a Free Gift, The Gates Foundation and the Price of Philanthropy. This was a somewhat critical take on the emergence of large philanthropic players with an emphasis on the Gates Foundation, and having spent now at least 6 years or so with a Google Scholar alert set up to the Mr. Gates and the Gates Foundation, I thought it's about time. The book came out in 2015. I will leave this, and I told John I'm going to emphasize something entirely different and not mention the Gates Foundation, but then something occurred that to be was notable enough that I decided to emphasize the Gates Foundation. That was Gates Foundation's 2017 annual letter. This was notable for reasons that I hope become clearer as my talk goes on, but the letter was a really good illustration of some of my concerns with what I see as an actual surprising lack of evidence surrounding the direct effects of certain philanthropic disbursements when it comes to global health. Who here happened to have seen the 2017 annual letter? Anyone? Nobody? No one? Okay. Let me go through what was notable about the letter. It involves a little bit of a preamble, and I've got quite a few slides to get through, so if I'm talking too quickly, interrupt at some point, but I'll give some background. Every year, the Gates Foundation, or for the past 6 or 7 years, the Gates Foundation has released a sort of letter to the world that details some of the successes and sometimes failures that might have occurred with some of its grants over the past 12 months. And this year, they put a public letter on that was addressed to Warren Buffett in response to Buffett's request to essentially give him and the world a record of how his investment in the Gates Foundation had been spent since 2006. The Gates Foundation and its endowment comes from two large sources. One is the personal fortune of Mr. Gates, but about half the money in the Gates Foundation was donated, consists of shares in Buffett's conglomerate, which is Berkshire Hathaway, which in 2006, he announced a donation of $30 billion worth of shares in Berkshire Hathaway to the foundation, a gift that is taking place in incremental stages, okay? So a big portion of the Gates Foundation's endowment comes from Buffett, and he asked them to give essentially a measure, an indication of how the money had been spent. The Gates Foundation's annual letter was therefore addressed to Buffett. It said, here is a sense of the good that your money is doing, okay? And it went through a number of really impressive and commendable global health gains that have been realized in the past 15, 20, 25 years, okay? One of the notable things about the letter was that it did not draw on any internal data from the Gates Foundation, but pointed to publicly available charts from places derived with credit, from places like The Economist magazine and elsewhere, that pointed to some leading positive indicators. For example, one of the main success stories mentioned was the reduction in under 5 childhood deaths over the past 25 years. What was notable about this, though, was that each of the successes that were pointed to, not a single one could be said to be directly or even predominantly attributable to Gates Foundation funding, okay? Not a single one of the gains when it comes from contraception use, which was something they highlighted, and where you could actually mark out the Gates Foundation's positive contribution, I think, in a more explicit way than they actually themselves underscored. But particularly when it came to this under 5 childhood death reduction, it was quite notable that in a way they were slightly, you could argue, claiming predominance or primacy for this global health success. And this is notable because although in the preface to the letter, they did make it very clear that they were detailing, as they put it, the world's successes when it comes to global health over the past 25 and 30 years. The take-home message, as I'll talk about in a bit, that media derived from that letter, was these are the deaths, these are the lives saved that we can thank Mr. Buffett and Mr. Gates for, okay? I'm concerned by this for a number of reasons. One is that, as Mr. Gates has himself acknowledged, what the Gates Foundation offers towards global health annually is simply a drop in the bucket compared to overseas development assistance towards all overseas development aid. So for example, the Gates Foundation's outlays hovered about the $2 to $3 billion mark when it comes for all its health and development disbursements. It's also got about $1 billion going towards US educational programs annually. So it spends about $4 billion annually. Mr. Gates often, I'm quite critical of the Gates Foundation, so this talk will be critical, but I hope to explain why. But essentially, as we know, as many people in the room know, essentially development aid from OECD countries hovers at about the $130 billion mark annually, and that doesn't even take into account non-OECD countries like China, okay? So the question is, even if the Gates Foundation, even if it was a big player when it comes to development aid, and it's not, in comparison to governments, is it fair for them to be essentially pointing to aid, world aid, as a catalytic factor in reducing under five childhood deaths? Arguably, you could say it's not a fair claim, given that there's quite a lack of consensus from economists over whether or not aid has been a determining factor or played a decisive role in reducing childhood deaths annually. We know that China's growth is attributable, can be held responsible for a lot of the poverty reduction that we've seen in the last 30 years, for example, and it hasn't been primarily overseas development aid, which has been responsible for for lowering poverty rates globally, and that China's own economic growth has played a determining factor in that. We don't know exactly what is leading to improved under five childhood deaths, but there's a growing concern, or at least some consensus, that aid doesn't seem to have been the decisive factor in cutting childhood mortality. So why does it matter? Why does it matter if Gates is somehow claiming, or at least implying, that his and Mr. Buffett's philanthropy is directly responsible for some of the major global health gains that we've seen over the past 30 years? And one of the other notable things about childhood death reduction, as Mr. Gates has himself acknowledged, is that it's been falling since the mid-1980s. The Gates Foundation did not come onto the scene until 1994, and then it was formally established in 2000 following a combining of two smaller organizations that led to the Gates Foundation in 2000. So its own existence has only been about 20 years when you count the predecessor bodies that were then formed in 2000. So it's notable that Gates was also in some ways claiming a little bit of direct primacy for things that had been occurring far, far before he began to disperse any of his money philanthropically, or a good proportion of his money philanthropically. Despite this, the take-home message from both right-leaning and left-leaning media, such as The Atlantic magazine would be one of the bits up. It's like similar to New Yorker or Harper's as a sort of left of center, but fairly centrist, liberal news organ in the United States, okay? And here was Goldberg's take on the annual letter. And you've probably read it for yourself. He's indicating that aside from George Bush, there's no one else in the world who could be said to be responsible for saved as many lives globally. No mention of the global gag rule that was obviously in place during Mr. Bush's incumbency and then removed and then brought back into force with Mr. Trump. But I would say that The Atlantic's take on the letter derived the exact conclusion that I suggest many members of the public would have taken from it, which is that they are directly claiming a level of primacy from the health gains realized globally. And they also note that essentially they're big believers in the inexorable nature of progress, not only because they've been treated kindly but fate, not only because they've concluded that America's fortunes cannot be reversed during a single four-year presidential term, but because they have overseen a rather remarkable experiment in data-driven philanthropy. And I think in many ways they have. They've been sponsoring a lot of useful and important health data on global burden of disease, and as well as things like malaria reduction. But that letter itself was not at all data-driven, and if anything, it was very notable for an absence of any internal data about how the Gates Foundation itself measures its own successes when it comes to its philanthropic disbursement. So it was a very non-evidence-based letter, and it showed no internal data to support claims of its own enhanced efficacy when it comes to being a significant player in global health. Mr. Goldberg went on to say that to contest Gates and Buffett against Trump, to say that the biggest difference between these individuals is that essentially we have Gates and Buffett who are data-oriented and rely on evidence to assert claims and have a faithfulness and a felicity to the importance of, and a fidelity, sorry, to the importance of truth in contrast to Mr. Trump. So Goldberg says, both men appear to doubt some of President Trump's innovations in rhetoric and policy. Both men have warm feelings about immigrants and also about facts, and are predisposed to react skeptically to recent developments in the Capitol, to recent developments in DC. When I asked about the Trump administration's problematic relationship with empiricism, Gates said, I predict a comeback for the truth. Why does this matter? Why does this matter when you have juxtaposed on one side people who are purportedly much more focused on data and loyal to the importance of empiricism juxtaposed against someone like Trump? Well, it's problematic because in essence, the perception that Mr. Gates is propagating is the idea that his philanthropic organization is uniquely and specifically inefficient when it comes to allocating resources because of their emphasis on data. And yet they themselves have not necessarily shown data in that annual letter that supports their idea or their claims to enhanced efficacy in comparison to, say, public sector actors. And in many cases, and many times, Mr. Gates is actually quite outspoken about the value of governments and their importance. And I think this is an area where it's contradictory, because in some ways he's claiming that we need to exhort governments to do more. But that letter might have been a key area where they could have, say, drawn on comparative data just to show just how much governments are doing in order to convey a public impression that was a little bit more, I would say, faithful to an accurate empirical representation of who is most responsible for global health disbursements when it comes to aid flows. So that letter was a key chance to say, point out that what they do is a drop in the bucket compared to governments, and that might have been a more accurate representation of the state of global health disbursements than their letter actually was. So I would say they are being just as creative with the truth in many ways as Mr. Trump is. Why does that matter? Well, if you're a little bit skeptical about some of Mr. Trump's pronouncements, we have to understand why his faithful followers do tend to believe him, even when he's clearly lying. It's because they think that the media is biased, the mainstream media. And this clear bias in Mr. Goldberg's report actually gives support to the supporters of Mr. Trump, who are saying, essentially, it's not that they're post-truth, they want a better understanding of the clarity of global health developments that they don't feel that they're getting from mainstream media. And in some ways, they're legitimate in requesting that level of clarity, because this is a clear indication where Mr. Goldberg's take on Mr. Buffett and the letter to Mr. Buffett is a misleading one. Okay, whether Mr. Goldberg simply can't read the letter in what I would call an empirically accurate way, or whether he's deliberately lying, it's a misleading take on Mr. Gates' whole time in office and Buffett's take to suggest that they themselves are responsible for saving lives globally. Just as dubious as the presumption that George W. Bush is responsible for saving lives globally. Why does this matter? I think it matters for political reasons that are important for understanding when we look at major changes that are happening in global health financing and development financing. The take-home message from the letter is that Gates has been perhaps the most significant player in improved global health outcomes. And this has normative implications for general understandings of the failures of governments to resolve certain global problems, global volatility, and the ability of market actors to essentially pick up the pieces left by failing states. So we're seeing a strong emphasis towards libertarian social movements. I'm not trying to necessarily knock libertarian social movements, but I'm trying to understand where the public salience for these movements come from. And part of the place where they come from is because of the enhanced assumption that private actors are uniquely responsible for realizing successful development outcomes. Okay. So I would argue that the rise of the libertarian impulse, as well as the rise of what some are starting to call market authoritarianism, can be attributed to a sort of presumption that I'm going to argue, as the talk goes forward, is rooted in a quite long-standing political economy, but it's resurgent today, surrounding the idea that private actors are naturally and intrinsically more efficient than public ones, and therefore, the argument for political economy implies more munificent naturally more generous in fostering positive social outcomes than public sector ones, if you believe the claim that they are intrinsically more efficient. And this is largely fueled by celebration of the sort of purportedly uniquely entrepreneurial acumen of certain private players who are able to bring the so-called efficiency to global health developments. But actually, when you look at the evidence surrounding that comparative efficacy, and particularly when it comes to realizing certain positive global health gains, the evidence base is actually surprisingly thin, as I think Mr. Gates probably realized when he went to reply to Trump's or Buffett's request for evidence of exactly what the Gates Foundation has achieved specifically. We know that social outcomes are very complex, and in some ways, it's not in any way Mr. Gates' fault that he can't show a causal or even a correlative sort of association with certain health gains, but his failure to admit that is the concern that I am emphasizing here, because I think the failure to admit that fuels rhetorical assumptions of unique private sector efficacy. This is also linked to a new development in charity and humanitarianism, which is the effect of altruism movement. Have people here heard of this new paradigm? Anyone? No? Let me just define it quickly. Okay. Basically, effective altruism, it's got strong links to bioethicists based in Oxford, part of the transhumanist movement, the idea that we're moving to an unprecedented global possible catastrophes requires extra emphasis placed on the solutions that matter when it comes to improving development and health, okay? And the fact that we're here at one of the organizations that's been really most invested and very responsible for leading developments in global health internationally, but you're not actually familiar with this movement, and I would argue some of them are likely not familiar with some of the work you do, points to a bit of a disjuncture between some of the newer players who are interested in global health and development based at places like the School Center for Social Entrepreneurship, based at places like I think the Gates Foundation is obviously very familiar with the work you're doing, but some of the newer effective altruist enthusiasts are people who are not actually familiar with long-standing developments in global health and global governance that are integral to understanding global stability today, okay? It's also linked to utilitarian thinkers like Peter Singer, who are well known for arguing that a little bit of charity can go a long way, and there's something to support that claim, but the question is, how do we actually determine the efficacy of different charitable investments? It's a little bit more complex than I think some of the EA enthusiasts propose or suggest. And one of my biggest concerns with EA enthusiasts is that they look at an organization like the Gates Foundation and they presume it has a level of inherent efficacy that other organizations lack, and I myself have not seen evidence to support that assumption. And I think I myself was particularly excited about the 2017 letter when I saw that they were going to make a sort of internal accounting of their own success rates. I thought they would get information I was never able to do, because people would continually ask me, can't you tell us about some of the great things the Gates Foundation has done for global health? And I would say, well, I'm sure they exist. Vaccines, for example, has been one area. But we also know vaccines affordability has skyrocketed in the past 12 years. So it's hard to determine a cost-benefit analysis of what's been the big global health gains or not. And that's why I was surprised, but also astonished that their letter didn't itself provide that information. And this leads to my own thesis, which underpinned my whole interest in the Gates Foundation when I started looking into the organization 8 years ago, which is, are they really as efficacious comparatively than they claim? And particularly, are presumptions like Mr. Singer's suggestion that Ms. Bill and Melinda Gates and Warren Buffett are the most effective altruists in history? Well, it's obviously a bit hyperbolic, but how much hyperbole is there? I wanted to understand just how evidence-based are claims the superior efficacy of large donors such as the Gates Foundation. And the conclusion that I reached in my book and some other publications is that claims are very overblown, especially when you look at overall charity levels and the assumption that Gates is leading some sort of golden new period of charity that rivals the earlier golden period that we saw flourishing at the end of the 19th century that led people like John Rockefeller and Carnegie to developed major and very positive contributions to biomedical advances. We know that Rockefeller, for example, was responsible for a lot of the funding for your institution. So there is obviously historically some predecessors to Mr. Gates in current, the rise of current new purportedly more strategic models of philanthropy. And a lot of my work's been interested in trying to compare them. And one of the main points that I reach in my book is that actually there's no evidence to support the idea that the Gates Foundation is playing a heightened role comparatively when it comes to its size next to, say, the overall size of the US economy, okay? So although adjusted for 2006 dollars, the gift of $31 billion from Mr. Buffett to Gates representing more than Rockefeller and Carnegie gave away combined, comparatively, when you look at a body like the Ford Foundation, it represented double the share of the US GDP back in the 60s in comparison to the Gates Foundation 50 years later. So sure, on a dollar basis, the Gates Foundation is comparatively bigger, but in proportionate size to the US economy, it's smaller than earlier predecessors. And this is particularly true if you go back to the early 20th century and you look at the size of what, the size of the endowments of the Carnegie Corporation, the Rockefeller Foundation, in comparison to the overall US economy. As well, though, on a per capita basis, even when you see the enormous sums donated and spent annually by Mr. Gates and large foundations, and even though foundations themselves are growing quite rapidly, expanding from about sort of 40,000 active foundations to over 85,000 active foundations over the past 20 years, that doesn't mean more money is actually being donated to charity. So since the 1970s, overall charitable giving in the US as a share of GDP has really strayed far from 2%. I said there were a lot of slides and then I talked very quickly. I've still got at least 20 minutes, right, John? I'm trying to make sure I'm, but if anyone has questions as I'm going along, please stop me. I would have assumed that this would probably be fairly familiar to many people here, but let me just go through it in brief. But essentially, and then when you try to understand how philanthropic giving towards global health compares to the past as well as to governments, we're not actually seeing much to suggest that there is this unique, that the Gates Foundation has a claim to uniqueness when it comes to overall influence, well possibly influence, which is harder to measure empirically, but certainly from a monetary basis. When you look at what the Gates Foundation spends compared to governments, as well as what it spends towards global health compared to a body like the Rockefeller Foundation in the 30s and 40s, you don't actually see much exceptionality to the Gates Foundation. So it's offered about 18 to 20 billion to health since its inception. It was since 1994. That's a crude estimate. It could be something like 22 billion, but it's not an estimate. We know what they give annually, and I've just crudely added it together. But for example, PEPFAR represented 18 million over a four-year period. And that's more than the Gates Foundation has given over its lifetime to health. So just compared to particular governmental initiatives, what the Gates Foundation is spending is a drop in the bucket. And yet, it's able to leverage its donations in a way that exerts considerable influence. So about 400 or 500 million each year goes to the WHO, and that amounts to about 10% of the WHO's overall budget. It works with about 3 to 4 billion annually. So you see how these large disbursements, while comparatively rather insignificant compared to state actors, are targeted and leveraged towards particular institutions, which enable the Gates Foundation to a number of scholars have said, direct certain funds towards particular disease initiatives, which might not be aligned with, which are shown to be not necessarily aligned with global burden of disease estimates and the most needed sort of investments. But that's not a unique problem with the Gates Foundation, as we know. The WHO in general doesn't necessarily have a disbursement model that's aligned with global burden of disease needs. It's lack of investment in non-communicable diseases, historically, that's now trying to rectify is just one example. And yet, even that doesn't suggest the Gates Foundation's exceptionality, the fact that it funds about 10% of the WHO's overall budget. If you look at a body like the Rockefeller Foundation, before the WHO was formally incepted in about, I think it was 1948, its predecessor was the League of Nations Health Organization, founded in 1922, and for decades, this predecessor body was reliant for almost half of its operating budget directly on the Rockefeller Foundation. So what is new? And I do want to get to my second emphasis on public-private partnerships. This is, I think, an important rhetorical novelty, something that is distinctive about the Gates Foundation and about the assumption that private actors are uniquely able to resolve certain problems that state actors are incapacitated from doing so. We've heard of the term philanthrocapitalism. Some people in the room have heard the term philanthrocapitalism, I presume. Introduced by Bishop and Green, who are news writers, essentially, philanthrocapitalism is generally defined in two main ways. The first is the suggestion that development actors and philanthropic bodies are increasingly trying to harness business modeling models and operating strategies from the corporate sector in order to improve the efficiency of their giving practices. Charged with the second way that philanthrocapitalism is often defined is the idea, as Bishop and Green put it, that capitalism itself, through fueling economic growth, is naturally altruistic and philanthropic by fostering a sort of dynamism that leads to collective prosperity. Okay, so the idea that capitalism is naturally philanthropic is how they define the notion of philanthrocapitalism. Whether or not you agree with that assertion, the point I make is that it's not a new one. Okay, the idea that private enterprise will lead to public prosperity is really, you could argue, the founding kernel of classical theories of political economy. You can see it in Adam Smith's work, but also prior to Adam Smith's work, the work of people like Bernard Mandeville, who was a thinker who influenced Smith greatly through Mandeville's argument that private vice produces public benefit. So in my work, I've traced this genealogy by drawing in on, particularly on the work of thinkers like Albert Hirschman, whose excellent genealogical book, The Passions and the Interests, essentially tries to trace the notion of the invisible hand in political theory, the notion that private enterprise has naturally civilizing effects by fostering an emphasis placed on sort of mutual cooperation being beneficial for all. Through promoting self-interest, you lead to an environment of mutual prosperity. Hirschman is also very clear and notes explicitly that the idea that private enterprises produces public benefits has, of course, been much contested by conflicted political theories which argue the opposite, such as Marx's work in the mid-19th century, which suggested that private enterprise can be destructive by fueling incentives that are misaligned with public interest. Okay, so Hirschman points out that you see a number of different competing theories of welfare, and the idea that private enterprise is naturally beneficial has had a long history of contestation. The new philanthrocapitalists tend to ignore the competing histories, and when they do mention the past, it's only to sort of suggest that there is this legacy that underscores the idea that capitalism is naturally beneficial. You can see this idea resurface in different historical points quite clearly, especially through someone like Carnegie, who was very influenced by Smithian notions of the natural prosperity of private enterprise. And he actually drew on those notions in order to, in some ways, really defend his own idea, his challenge to labor unions, which he initially supported and then withdrew his support from as they began placing more demands on, as they began to unionize at his own plans. What's different, I think, between then and now, between Carnegie's time and now, is that his suggestion, for example, that his own private wealth embodied the interests of a wider community because he had the acumen to distribute his wealth in a way that a community could not be as well devised or placed to see itself. He suggested that his enhanced business skills made him uniquely able to disperse his fortune. That idea was largely derided, okay, by public and by Congress, including by members of the US Congress, who, as the idea was voiced by people like Rockefeller was denied a charter for a federal charter to establish his philanthropy in the 1910s because he was seen as essentially an abuser of the public through some of his business practices. The oil company that he had founded, where his fortune was derived from, Standard Oil, had just been the subject of one of the most infamous antitrust suits in US history, So it wasn't a good time for Rockefeller to be pointing to his own wealth as naturally publicly useful or munificent. Okay, so he was actually denied a charter and he needed to incorporate in New York in order to establish his philanthropic organization. This is very different than today, when there's far less skepticism over the idea that private wealth is naturally publicly beneficial. And what I suggest is new about the current era is not that the idea that private interest leads to public benefits, it's not novel, it's a founding kernel of political economy. It's the assumption of the idea that that point is uncontestable, mixed with an almost triumphant hubris surrounding the idea that therefore we should better capitalize private companies to foster more private wealth because it's inevitably publicly useful. Okay, so that's the novelty, not the claim, but the success of the claim, and in the exponential growth of the claim chimed with an almost reversal of what corporate philanthropy even means. Previously, corporate philanthropy meant some of companies trying to use their resources to try to improve negative externalities. Now, for various reasons in economic thought, the problem of negative externalities has been largely contested as a major problem through things like the Coase theorem, which were reintroduced in the 1940s and 50s, and you're seeing a novel capitalization on the belief that private philanthropy can be used to fuel private profits by people who are positioning themselves as deserving charity claimants. So for example, the Gates Foundation has given tens of millions in non-repayable grants to corporations like Scholastic, MasterCard, and Vodacom over the years, and there's been a lot of unknowns that this practice is even happening. So one of the reasons why they legitimate a donation, a direct gift to a body like MasterCard, is the idea that MasterCard will use the money to set up, to expand into areas where it might not have expanded because they were too high risk, developing regions. And yet this is a very novel development that has no precedent in philanthropy, in which I've argued on the record a few times, I think does skirt charity regulations in the States. I think it is illegal, because technically the only time you're able to give money directly to a what's called a non-501c3 organization, which is a for-profit organization, a non-nonprofit organization, it has to be done in a way that's furthering your own charitable mandate and in a way that the recipients are not able to use the money for anything other than charitable purposes. But MasterCard has been using the money to expand its business operations in places like Nairobi, so I argue that this skirts charity regulations in the United States. Despite this fact, I think we're going to see the trend continue rather unchallenged from a legal perspective, especially as we're seeing the rise of social investment movements, which are calling for essentially more philanthropy to go to the companies that need it the most. This is not that distinctive from public subsidies towards the private sector, but it is distinctive that it's coming from large philanthropic organizations, which in the past were presumed not even to be legally able to give their money directly to corporations. And I've had ongoing debates with charity scholars in the States who were very confused about the Gates Foundation's new practices here and whether they breached charity regulations or not. I'd be happy to talk about this in discussion periods, but I do want to get to my promised emphasis in this talk, which I've massively failed to emphasize, and I still have a fair few slides to get through, which is how this is affecting public-private partnerships. Well, unfortunately, I can't do a huge survey of all these different types of collaborations. You will be, many of you, much more familiar with many of these type of partnerships than I am, because my emphasis on looking at private-public partnerships in greater depth, divorced from my earlier focus on the Gates Foundation, is a very new project for me. So I'm just starting to explore these developments, although I have written about one specific public-private partnership, which is the Advanced Market Commitment for Pneumococcal Vaccines, which I'll talk about in a minute. But as you will know better than I can really impart today, there's broadly three different types of collaborative areas. There's private finance initiatives, which have been a long-standing model in the United States, where a service is essentially contracted out to the private sector in order to derive some sort of capital financing, and contracts are put in place where the government agrees to pay a certain amount in response to the financing provided for things like the financing of hospitals, schools, major forms of different public finance initiatives. And then there's different push and pull mechanisms, new collaborative funding efforts built around specific diseases. So for example, the advanced market commitment for a vaccine for pneumococcal diseases was developed through the Gavi Alliance through money that came from a mixture of both private actors and governments. And then there's a whole host of obviously new multilateral organizations like the Global Fund, which are considered broadly in the terrain of public-private partnerships, but are very distinctive, obviously, from a private finance initiative. And one of the points that I'm trying to make about all these new collaborations, very broadly construed, is that often there's a mistaken presumption that the private sector providing capital funding in exchange for a set commitment to pay a certain amount, when in reality, it's not necessarily the private sector who's providing financing. It's obviously often public bodies or philanthropic ones. And often they use a language emphasizing market-type competitive models, but in reality, they're the opposite of a competitive model, and the word like market really semantically shouldn't be used in the partnership, in the collaboration. So one of the best examples of this was the pneumococcal vaccine, okay? This was the first and only advanced market commitment to date. And the idea of an advanced market commitment is that essentially, as many of you know, a lot of neglected disease research just doesn't get funded because there's not a market of paying customers or clients or patients who have the monetary resources to pay for the type of treatments that a wealthier population could afford. So this is the idea of different push and pull mechanisms. A push mechanism being early investment provided by a public actor that is then hopefully capitalized by a private one. A pull mechanism is this idea of a prize fund or an advanced market commitment, the pull being the idea if they roll out this particular technology or treatment, they will receive a guaranteed amount at the end from the guarantor of the prize. So in the case of the pneumococcal vaccine, this was through the Gavi Alliance. A number of countries in particular devoted the bulk of the money for the pneumococcal vaccine. The Gates Foundation put some money towards it, and in response, GlaxoSmithKline and Vaccine started rolling out a pneumococcal vaccine that they had in development, but they didn't have a huge monetary incentive for rolling out in a manner that they received once they got the advanced market commitment promised to them. Thanks, John, that's great. And then, the reality of this new model, it wasn't that the vaccine in many ways was a success, but we don't know how costly it was for the people providing the subsidy. We don't know how much GlaxoSmithKline and Pfizer profited themselves, and if it was excessive amount of profit, you could argue, as Medecins Sans Frontières did, that it would have been cheaper to try to procure the vaccine through typical UNICEF procurement channels. Why don't you know how costly it was for the vaccine to be rolled out? Well, because GlaxoSmithKline had no obligation to share manufacturing cost data. It's commercially protected information. And this problem of the inaccessibility of commercially protected information is one of the major concerns for all novel sorts of blended finance mechanisms, efforts to enroll private sector actors in service delivery or development efforts. It's hindered by this, I would argue, strong epistemological barrier to judging efficacy, which is the fact that so much proprietary data is legally permitted to be kept confidential. I mean, it's not a novel point I'm raising. This is a long-standing problem in a lot of public-private collaborations, but it's being exacerbated by the fact that the lack of evidence surrounding cost-effectiveness is often taken, it's often ignored itself, okay? So there's a lot of general ignorance surrounding the fact that this is a problem. And I consider this the transparency paradox, okay? New actors that are purported to be more efficacious because they are for profit and therefore seen as being more cost effective because they have an inherent competitive impulse for being so, in reality, they're not acting in a market-based manner. So there is no competitive reason to minimize costs. And there's a lot of reasons to inflate costs and not be candid about manufacturing processes because there's no legal impulse to do so. So we know, for example, that private finance initiatives in the United Kingdom, there was cross-partisan perceptions of the fact that they were very costly for taxpayers. There's been some evidence of efficacy and some evidence of cost-effectiveness, in some areas, but for the most part, a lot of criticism of how costly they have been to taxpayers, despite this cross-partisan vociferous acknowledgement that UK PFIs have often been very cost onerous rather than effective, PPEs and global development are being embraced on the basis of an economic theory which underlines their usefulness and utility, but not a lot of evidence, A, around the idea that they could be leading to significant poverty reduction. There's actually no evidence that any of the significant amounts of money that are being channeled from development finance institutions to new private sector recipients are having any role, palpable role in poverty reduction. Now that evidence is also very hard to come by, so it's not necessarily the fault of development finance organizations, but despite the lack of evidence, it's not been a barrier towards reducing this general trend. And that at a time of growing austerity both in northern regions and southern regions is a concern, because all of these effects are not cost neutral, they have an effect on public finances. So if we're channeling more direct subsidies to wealthy recipients, what I'm calling rich-to-rich giving, we need to be doing so in a context of better evidence surrounding their effectiveness. 5 more minutes or so. And this is acknowledged, but it's something of an open secret. It's a known problem that there's a lack of solid evidence surrounding increased public and private money going to private recipients and the lack of any good knowledge on whether they've been useful in poverty reduction. So one of the most useful documents describing this new phenomenon was a publication by Patty Carter, based at the Overseas Development Institute, published in 2015. And he is very much a proponent of the idea that blended finance initiatives have a great deal of usefulness in improving global outcomes. But he himself has pointed out that there's a lack of evidence surrounding their effectiveness, and he himself has acknowledged that this leaves funders and donors in an uncomfortable position. So as he's put it, even as if one is prepared to believe, on the basis of economic theory, that accelerating investment is likely to have a positive impact on long-run poverty reduction via channels that are likely to elude impact evaluation exercises, spending money in the absence of evidence is not a comfortable position to be in. And yet he goes on to suggest that based on the strength of the theory underpinning the idea that this will be auspicious, he defends the idea that we should continue to do it. And what I am now leading to in upcoming work is more of a scrutiny on how widespread knowledge of the lack of evidence base is, what efforts have been taken to improve the evidence base, and also how we can start to challenge assumptions of comparative private sector efficiency when we don't have a reliable empirical evidence base to support them. And this is very important when it comes to a moral normative case for taxation, because I've really loaded up the PowerPoint and it's a new topic I'm getting into, it's been a slightly more disjointed talk than I would have liked to have given, but I want to spend my last 5 minutes talking about why I see this as such a problem when it comes to rhetorical efforts to make a stronger moral case for heightened taxation on high earners as well as corporate tax. All forms of taxation need to be predicated on the idea that a public sector can, in some ways, do good money with public revenues. Increasingly, debates over global inequality are being framed in terms of who are going to be providing solutions to the problem. Well, someone like Gates has explicitly rejected people like Thomas Piketty's call for heightened taxes, a global wealth tax, on the basis of his own efficiency, and yet we don't have an evidence base to support his claims, and therefore, what are the larger cultural implications of this? This is what I'm trying to investigate, but I'll make a last point emphasizing, drawing on an example with Gates and Mr. Piketty, why I think this is such a problem. So we know the history of economic neoliberalism in the 20th century is one of a successful ability of economists aligned with supply-side economic theory, which is really the technical term for what's more crudely and broadly known as trickle-down economics, which is not a position that economists themselves, a language they've used, but supply-side economics is the idea that if you increase private sector expansion, you're going to see wider public effects. And this is largely based on the idea of public externalities fostered by a less regulated private sector. The idea that the less you restrain market expansion, corporate growth, all forms of economic growth, the more you will see trickle-down positive externalities flourish. This is important because I think we are starting to, on the basis of assumptions of the validity of this theory, see increasingly a dissolution of the divide between for-profit and non-profit activities, something that will likely constrain money available for non-profit recipients of philanthropic money, especially when someone like Mr. Gates is equating investing in companies with having the same social utility as investing in non-profit charitable goods, okay? So Mr. Gates has talked a lot about the problem of economic inequality, but he has contested most efforts to try to rectify the problem through increasing taxation. Although in some cases he has been contradictory, he's called, for example, for higher capital gains tax in the United States. When it comes to practical efforts to make such suggestions a reality, he has largely challenged them and explicitly suggested that there's less of a case for taxation than someone like Mr. Piketty makes. Thomas Piketty is the author of Capital in the 21st Century, which was the best-selling book trying to understand global inequality, published in 2015. And Mr. Gates published a response to Piketty, where essentially he tried to make a case for heightened philanthropy being a better response than the type of policy measures that Mr. Piketty was calling for. And in his response to Piketty, he painted a picture of, as he put it, three guys, okay? He said, imagine these three guys. One investing in companies, one in philanthropy, and one in a lavish lifestyle. And then he says, you know, nothing wrong with the last guy, but I think you should pay more taxes than the other. And much like his annual letter in 2017, this is embraced by the media. This is Gates making a really good case that investing in companies or giving to philanthropy should offset tax obligations. If you read that carefully, he's actually making a very radical claim of the equivalent social utility of any form of company investment and comparing that to philanthropic disbursements. That is a claim that even someone like Rockefeller or Carnegie would have never made because of the effort to try to separate their philanthropic expenditures from their business empires. So to equate investing in companies to a philanthropy writ large is actually a shocking statement, but one that is increasingly being accepted as normalized and a natural way to understand grant disbursements. And I want to end briefly with Mr. Zuckerberg and his new foundation, because it's an important footnote to the story. But another reason why Mr. Gates' suggestion that investing in companies is equivalent to philanthropy, from someone like Piketty's perspective, it actually misreads or directly ignores Piketty's entire argument and emphasis on the idea, as he puts it, that one of the reasons that we have growing national inequality in wealthy nations like the UK and the US, it's because returns to private investors are outpacing overall national growth levels at such an alarming pace, at such a heightened ratio, that we're starting to see general inequality. Now that, which he formalizes with the ratio of R versus G. Now that R versus J, G concept of Piketty is not at all presumed. There's no consensus around whether or not it's a good way to conceptualize inequality, but it does point out that essentially we have heightened wealth concentration, it's empirically defended by Piketty, and it's something that he links to growing inequality. So Gates essentially then, it doesn't just make the theoretical claim that investing in companies is as useful as disbursements towards nonprofit recipients, he makes good on the claim by increasingly devoting a lot of the Grants Foundation's money to bodies like Vodacom, MasterCard, Scholastic, which are themselves very well capitalized. At a time of heightened corporate profitability and increased tax evasion, the question of whether we should be further subsidizing private sector actors is a problematic one. My last point, this problem is likely to get far worse in future years as you see the rhetorical salience of Mr. Gates' assumption of private sector public utility start to disseminate amongst other large donors. And the epitome of this has been the instantiation of the foundation from Zuckerberg, okay? his creation of the Chan Zephyrker Initiative that was hailed as a charitable gesture and a philanthropic one, but actually was not. Mr. Zuckerberg did not set up a traditional philanthropy to disperse his money. He simply set up a new limited liability company and transferred some of his Facebook shares to the new LLC. And he will purportedly use the money in the LLC to further philanthropic causes. I have no doubt that he will try to do that in many respects, that he's well-intentioned in some degree, and he will give some of that money to charity, to nonprofits, but we will never know how much. Because unlike the Gates Foundation, which is publicly needs to provide a list of all its grant disbursements on what are called 990 forms, which are it must comply with through IRS regulations, in which it has a duty to provide public access to upon request, in which it very, I think, commendably provides really good access to on its website. The reason why we know the Gates Foundation is giving direct grants to places like MasterCard is because it's all clearly listed on its 990 forms. Because Zuckerberg's new entity is an LLC, it's not subject to the same disclosure requirements. It's not subject to any minimum payout, so we don't know for sure that it will actually need to be disbursing its money to different recipients. There's no onus for board of directors. It's essentially not subject to any of the regulations that govern the Gates Foundation. And so his LLC really represents a tactical move towards greater informational control and non-transparency. And the problem with this is that it furthers the practical dilemma I raised earlier, which is that claims to cost effectiveness of private actors and their unique acumen and skill is largely fueled through informational non-transparency and inability to do a rigorous cost effectiveness evaluation of different operating procedures because of commercial confidentiality. And in the case of Zuckerberg's LLC, I have no doubt that even more so than the Gates Foundation, we will hear nothing but the positive stories, because there's no pressure, no countervailing force at all permitting investigation of failed efforts. The only way we know what the Gates Foundation did wrong or right is because we can look at each grant and scrutinize what went wrong or didn't. If Zuckerberg will never have that capacity. Thank you, I'll end there.